Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Deeper Still, a podcast where we carve out space for meaningful conversation about God and life as we seek to pay attention to the ways he calls us to go deeper still in relationship with him and with one another. My name is Sue Ann Camfield. I have the joy of being the host of this podcast. And as always, my friends, I'm so glad you're joining us today. In today's episode, I want to have a conversation that we have yet to have had here on Deeper Still. And by my own confession, it's a conversation that's long overdue. It's a conversation about race. My guest today is most likely a new voice for most of my listening audience, but he has been a dear friend of mine for decades. His name is Ed Uzinski, and he is the author of the new book called Untangling Critical Race Theory, What Christians Need to Know and Why It Matters. That book actually releases today, June 25th, which is the same day we are dropping this episode. And so if this conversation whets your appetite, I would encourage you take a deeper dive and go get the book. All right, so let's just get something on the table. I said the words, I said it, critical race theory, it is out there. If you spend any time living in our culture today, you know that CRT is this incredibly triggering and divisive phrase. Depending on your background, depending on your race or ethnicity, your political framework, your theological framework, CRT often may mean something different to you than it does to your neighbor. And what happens, especially in the life of the evangelical church, because of that, is it's confusing. We don't know how to, as Ed's book says, untangle it. And so oftentimes we end up either demonizing people who don't think the same as we do, or we run away from it altogether. And I don't know about you, but I don't think either of those things are very helpful, especially in the life of the church. And so instead of moving away from a conversation about CRT, what we're going to do is we're going to lean in. We are going to move towards it. And I just want to tell you today that this conversation, while it does talk about CRT, and I just want to say I wanted to get into the nuts and bolts and the nitty-gritty of CRT, we actually do a little bit of that, but Ed and I have a different conversation. We have a conversation that also is just about race and injustice, inequality, and what that means for us as followers of Jesus Christ, what it means for his church, and how we can be on a journey of listening and learning together so that the kingdom, all of the kingdom, is better for it. So with that said, I want to introduce you to Dr. Ed Uzinski. Ed has a couple of significant theological degrees, as well as his PhD in American Cultural Studies from Bowling Green State University. He has worked within the church and parachurch organizations for more than three decades, and a lot of that time has been spent talking about issues of race and culture as a oneness and diversity consultant. He is a phenomenal preacher and biblical teacher. He has also written for many online platforms and is a frequent speaker and podcaster on topics of race, sports, culture, and marriage. I love what Preston Sprinkle says about Ed. He says, Ed is the smartest guy you've never heard of. And hopefully by the end of our conversation today, you are going to see why. I also want to just acknowledge before we get started that this conversation and really the target audience for Ed's book is people who predominantly find themselves in white evangelical spaces. Ed and I are having this conversation as two white people, speaking really to other white people for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part. So I just want to acknowledge that for any of my friends who are people of color listening, and just thank you in advance for your grace. All right, friends. Well, I'm excited about this conversation. I'm excited about the ground that we cover. Ed's going to share a little bit of his own journey. We're going to talk about why we get so defensive as white people talking about race often. We're going to talk about cross-cultural competency, ethnic indifference, and all kinds of other things. And so I appreciate you being on the journey with us. And so friends, wherever you find yourselves, whatever you're doing, saddle up, settle in, and listen in as Ed and I go deeper still. Well, Ed, welcome to Deeper Still. It is so good to have you here today, my friend.
good to be here. Been looking forward to this one ever since we first talked about doing it, which I think was actually a couple years ago, wasn't it? That we said, hey, we should do a podcast sometime if you ever get that book done. And now it's finally done. And so here's the podcast.
No kidding. I know. It's funny when I go back to my text messages and see when we first started having this conversation and how fun it is to see, like, when you actually put a book into the world that has been on your heart and your mind, and then you've done all the work, and then you have that physical book, and it's like, it's happening, and here we are.
Yeah, it's a whole nother podcast, isn't it? Just the whole process. Because once you get it finished, it's really not finished, right? There's so many still edits and all the front matter and everything that goes around it, and then go through it one more time, and then you start finding things you wish you could change, but they say you can't because of space. And it's something, isn't it? I know I don't want to distract you because we're here to talk about other things, but I know you know that.
You know, we need to have a, I tell you, first of all, there is like a Love and Author Day of the year or something. People need to understand that and love on authors. I tell you, the process and the vulnerability that it goes through to put your ideas into the world and then to sit with that. I remember having a conversation with my editor when she told me she wanted me to write another chapter after I thought it was done. Okay. And I went into a deep, dark place for many days. And yeah, it's no small thing, right?
It's not. And it's a hostile world we live in, especially if you're going to try to talk about anything that's got volatility attached to it, like race, for example.
I was going to say, it's a good thing we're not doing that today. Easy conversation.
Here we are.
Here we are. Well, Ed, I am actually super incredibly excited to have this conversation. We have so much ground to cover today, and so we're going to dive in a minute. But I just have to say this out loud and publicly, because I know we will have people tuning in today who know both of us, who know you and love you and are in your circles of relationship. I know we will have people that don't know you, but just, I have to have this personal moment with you, because I was thinking back to the fact that I have known you and your amazing wife, Amy, for, I know this because I can count the years of your oldest child. So I think for 23 years, that when I first met you guys, Eric and I were in our 20s. We had just come on staff with a parachurch organization where we met you guys. You were leading at that time what was called the World Training and Resource Center. And we got to sit under your leadership during that time. 2 years, I think we did that. And I look back to that time, and it is still one of the most formative, shaping faith experiences I have had. And that is so much because of your leadership, and not just your leadership, but the way you think and the way you challenge people to think, which is what I love about this book. But also, I need to have that moment with you, because now I'm sitting here 23 years later interviewing you on my podcast, and I'm having like a blown mind moment also. Like, God is just so crazy and good that way.
Pretty sure this would be the time to hit pause so we can both cry for a little bit after doing that. And that's generous and gracious, Sue Ann. I look back on those years so fondly too, because we were growing in community. I mean, it was an opportunity to be trained to do campus ministry or to ministry within sports teams. And so we were all there, you know, 9, 10, 15 of us sometimes, talking about different theological concepts and different ministry concepts and trying to grow in our emotional lives and in our spiritual lives and our cultural lives. We were mashing all that together. And it was about the conversations that we were having. We were all pushing each other. We were all challenging each other to think differently and just being real with each other, which has become sort of an expected idea. I wonder how much that's changed in the last 20 years, the vulnerability, the expectation for vulnerability in a group. I think it's still probably rare to actually have that, where people are just genuinely vulnerable and you're able to be yourself right where you're at, right where you're at in the process, and be accepted there and yet be challenged and pushed to keep growing, right? I think that's what church is supposed to be. And sometimes you have that in church settings and sometimes you don't, right? And so we had it in this parachurch setting in a way that marked all of us for a number of years. So I appreciate you giving a little shout out to that time. I miss it. I miss it too.
Yeah. Me too. Me too. Ironically, you were also one of the first people to start pushing me on some of these ideas surrounding race. I mean, all the way back then. And I am very appreciative for that as well. And I think one of the things you just brought up that's so interesting is that we need to have these conversations in community. We need to have these conversations in a way where when we're in relationship with one another, when we know one another's hearts and we know how we're wrestling with things, these conversations, so we're going to talk about lots of things today. We're going to say trigger words. We're going to say things that people are going to want to make assumptions about. But part of the reason I want this to be a helpful conversation, I think it's going to be helpful, is because we're going to remind people, when you know people, when you're in relationship and have these conversations in authentic ways, we are better for them. Our brothers and sisters are better for them. And hopefully, by the grace of God, the kingdom of God and his church are better for them.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And, you know, a lot of times we find ourselves, again, we're talking about race, we're talking about cross-cultural competency today. A lot of times we find ourselves in a monocultural setting where it's just a group of all white people, or it's a group of all black people in some cases. And to be able to talk about these things with that group is super helpful. But it's even better if you can get with people that are different, racially different, socioeconomically different. I mean, that's when I feel like I've had the chance to grow to the most, is when the truth of God's word is brought alive in the midst of people's very real social settings and their real lives, narratives, the story that they brought with them into the group. That's how I get challenged. That's how I get humbled. That's how I get pushed to let go of prejudices that I have, or a particular narrative that I've nurtured across my life. And I come to find out that that's not really true, or it's not always true. And that's when change has a chance to happen, right? So I do. I wish we all had more of that in our lives. I think just our cultural moment is desperate for more of those kinds of engagements with each other. Don't you think?
We don't have enough of them. And it's also why I want to start the conversation where we are going to start today, because exactly what you just said, Ed, you know, one of the things I laughed about, in fact, just before I came down to do this interview, I was telling someone about it. And the first thing they said is, "Oh, is he black?" when I was talking about you. And I'm like, "Nope, he's a white guy from Ohio." And there's an irony to that, right? That here you are, you wrote this book about critical race, Untangling Critical Race Theory, which I think is such an important part of that title. But God has been uniquely wiring together, knitting together your story with race and where he put you and how you grew. And you have a narrative that plays into how you got to writing this book. And I would love for our audience, if you could just start there. Take us to some of your personal journey with this issue that brought us to where we are today.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Sue Ann. And there ends up being a whole chapter in the book about this, which I really didn't plan when I set out to write the book. I didn't plan on devoting a whole chapter to it, but it makes sense that I would. Even as I've had to go back and revisit, I'm 56 now. And so when I think back 40, 45 years ago to where this started for me in a suburb that was on the west side of Cleveland, Ohio. And I happened to grow up at an intersection of Black, white, and Puerto Rican people, large populations of Black, white, and Puerto Rican people. Great history, actually, to how Puerto Rican folks wound up in this particular place on the west side of Cleveland. But it was all about jobs and work. And so really the whole area here is just very ethnically diverse. Beyond white, Black, and Puerto Rican, there's all kinds of different European heritages represented. There was an international festival that happened every summer where there was a parade and an international queen that was crowned. And so that's the waters that I swam in when I was young. And because I've asked myself, when did this, or how did this become so important to me? And I say, well, it's just the air that I breathed. And I realized, even when I went away to college, that that wasn't true for everybody. I just assumed that everybody sort of grew up in very racially and socioeconomically different, with different groupings together. And it wasn't really till I got to college that I realized how that really was more rare than it was the norm. You know, I met white folks who had never been around any Black folks. I met Black folks from inner city Cleveland that just had no white people really in their lives. Their schools were all, you know, Black teachers and Black principals, and they really didn't do white people all that much. And so that was really different for me. And I realized, I'll just say this, in the midst of all the different encounters that happened, I was a white guy who played basketball. I got good at basketball, which was a predominantly black sport then, as it is now. And so I was immersed in some sense, having to be a minority, to be the non-dominant cultural representative in that space, you know, across my junior high and high school years. And I realized that the role that I wound up playing a lot with people was cultural translator. So in other words, I found myself, I didn't try to be anything other than what I was in those spaces. I wasn't trying to be a black guy and, you know, black white guy, or, you know, trying to fix my white friends who needed to think a certain way about blackness. And again, the whole Puerto Rican aspect, again, there was enough racism to go around amongst all of us, you know, and I found myself trying to always help the group I was in to realize that the other groups were not always the way you're representing them. You know what I mean? When comments were being made, or that's just how they are, or whatever, I always felt a hitch in my spirit to want to say, yeah, that's not really actually how they are. Certainly not all the time. And I want you to realize that, like, I hang out with those guys over there, and that's not how they are. So I found myself operating as a cultural translator, and I wanted to understand, and I wanted other people to understand what was really going on with those other groups instead of just tolerating each other. And I think that's an important difference that I've even realized lately, that you can tolerate being in the same space with each other, and you'll say we're not racist, and that's all well and good. But tolerating each other and really understanding each other, like really being included with one another, being, if I could say, integrated with one another in the best sense of that term, that's a whole nother ballgame, you know? And it involves listening, and it involves asking lots of questions, and it involves letting go of the story that I've been handed about the others, whoever they are. Right. And that's not easy to do. So that's just the water I've swam in ever since I was a little kid, and all through college and grad schools and ministry life and the church, my church experiences. Again, there's so many different venues where I just kept winding up sort of on the other side of the tracks all the time, and going back and forth and trying to help people understand what was going on the other side.
It's so good. And that comes through so much in the book. And one of the things I love about the book is you are constantly pushing us to listen, right? I think you say over and over again, like, to slow down, pay attention to the narratives that are going through your head, pay attention to the people around you, take the time to get to know their stories. And, you know, in our world today, it moves so fast. We have so much being thrown at us. There are so many narratives that we're told to believe, and it's so hard to sort through them. And it's so hard for us, based on our own schedules and our families, to actually step back, to take the time to be intentional, not just to listen, but to be in proximity with people who are different from us.
Yeah.
In a way that changes who we are. That takes work.
It does. It does. And the ideal is to be with actual people, but you can get a lot done in the time that we live in now, just by getting exposed to podcasts that are being done by different people, and watching videos, right? And reading books. I mean, some of the usual suspects that help us to kind of gain understanding about people that are different from us. There are definitely ways to do it, but you're right. It always takes work. And it's work that maybe a lot of us have not been willing to say we wanted to put in. And so I think part of the challenge for us just as Christians, and those who have kind of a missions mindset, that we're supposed to be trying to impact the world for the gospel, I want to keep encouraging myself and others to say, hey, think about what it would mean to put a little more work in right now, you know, especially in an age where our political situation is such that we're being encouraged actually to get further away from each other and to build up higher walls, right? The political situation is not saying, hey, how can we work together and understand each other? It's saying they're the evil, the other is always evil, and we're going to keep to our own, and we're going to get stronger within our tribe. And that's just not the way of the kingdom. It's not. So I have to check myself when I'm doing that, because I do that just like anybody else does it. I have to check that and say, what step could I take or what space could I make in my life to actually make room to try to understand why those people over there think the way they do, whoever those people are, you know?
Well, Ed, one of the ways that you started to understand how others, if we're going to use that term, some others think and maybe differently from you, is you, a little bit later in your life, you're not that old, so sorry, I hate even saying later in life. I don't even know what that means, right? As I approach 50, I don't even know what that means.
It felt later to me. You can say later. It definitely felt later to me with a wife and three kids and a fourth on the way. It was later. Yeah.
It was later. All right. We'll leave it at that. You went to grad school and you had already gotten some theological degrees, but you intentionally chose to get your PhD at Bowling Green State University in American culture. Is that right? American studies, American culture?
It's a combination of those. American culture studies is what the program was called. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
And all of a sudden you found yourself in an environment with people who had a completely different worldview than what you were bringing to the table. And it was really the first time that you were really immersed in what this whole educational, academic, theological framework of critical theory that now gets us to critical race theory. We're going to unpack this a little bit, but you stepped into that environment and it kind of just blew a lot of your boxes. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what that experience was for you.
Yeah, that's good. And I could talk about this for a whole hour as I think back about it. I did want to go and get a secular degree. I really wanted to understand really what we just said. I was going to intentionally make space. I knew I wanted to get a terminal degree, a PhD degree. And I said, let me just go ahead and do a deep dive into trying to understand how secular society works the way it does. And so I don't even remember all the thinking process, but I was even shocked that they accepted me into the program. I mean, the guy that ran the program's name was Don McQuarrie, and he genuinely wanted diversity in this program. So I got to be white, heterosexual, looks a little military-ish, even though I'm not, athlete, Christian, evangelical, mostly conservative guy. And again, once I got there, I realized, oh, there's not too many others like me that they let in here right now, because it was just very mixed in. And it was definitely skewed in the direction of pretty radical progressivism in terms of the ideas that were embraced and just the worldview, the way of viewing the world. And really, you know, here's what the best way to even summarize that is that I felt like I was with people who had decided that there really was no God for the most part. There was no God to deal with. There was no being that existed outside of material life, you know, which was really interesting for people just to be firmly committed to that. And secondarily, what they felt like needed to happen in order for people to be completely free and to fully realize their humanity is to erase any lines that are drawn by other people that constrain them. So you would erase lines around sexuality. You'd erase lines around gender. You would erase lines around anybody that sort of represents, an oppressive conservatism. Which, of course, there's all kinds of contradictions in that. And at some point, you're going to have to put lines down somewhere. And you're erasing them only to put them down in other places, which is part of the role I played, I think, was to keep pointing that out along the way. But I gave myself fully over to it. I wasn't in any way deconstructing my faith. I wasn't in any kind of a faith crisis. I wasn't exploring what was wrong with my Christianity as much as I was wanting to understand better how my Christianity applied to a very broken and radically progressive world. So that's what happened. Across 5 years, I'd sat in a cohort of 15 people in a whole bunch of other classroom settings and try to negotiate that and navigate understanding.
Yeah, we could do a whole podcast on that, couldn't we? Just on your experience there. I'm gonna stop myself from wanting to ask a whole trail of questions based on that. You do talk about it often throughout the book, and so I think you do give some light to what that experience was like for you. But one of the things that happened during that time is you were really exposed to critical theory in a way that you had not been before. When we talk about critical theory, it is a broad range of thinking. It's rooted in Marxism. You have critical theory, and then critical race theory is one part of that. It's complicated. I mean, Ed, you spend the whole first part of your book really trying to help us, which I really appreciated, navigate and understand some of these huge things in a way that is substantive. Say that word for me. Substantive? Is that a word? Thank you. Substantive. Thank you. But accessible. I really appreciated that. And so I'm going to ask you a really just unfair and oversimplified question. But what is critical race theory and where does it come from?
Yeah, good. Well, and so can I back us up? Because you've said all three of them now. And I think it's important to realize that Marxism and critical theory and critical race theory, while they're all part of the same family, are really, really different disciplines. And they were trying to solve different problems. Again, they're part of the same tree, you could say. They're branches on the same tree. But they were trying to do different things. So I told you this, Sue-Ann, I've worked really hard to try to succinctly be able to put my mind around how to describe that Marxism. This is what I would say about Marxism, that Marx saw that separations between economic classes necessarily created animosity between the haves and the have-nots, but it also created alienation for people between themselves, between the products that they made, between the people that they were creating products with. Okay, so Marx's whole thing was capitalism necessarily, the system itself necessarily creates a breach between people. It creates this upper tier of society and it creates everybody else underneath it somewhere. Again, forget about what's good about it. This is what it does. And that separation, especially for the people that are down below, it really does this for everybody, but especially for the people that are down below, it creates a sense of alienation. They feel separated from themselves. They don't feel connected to the work that they're being asked to do in a factory. And they're in constant competition with everybody else. So Marxism was an exploration of that, the dehumanizing effect of this system that we've signed up for, that he kept saying doesn't have to be the only way we do life together. We could do this differently. Now, again, his solution wound up being catastrophic, but he wasn't wrong in saying we don't have to submit ourselves to this way of doing things where there is this huge separation socioeconomically, and the work that we wind up doing causes us to feel less than human. I thought that was super interesting, actually. It got me thinking a ton about what that actually means in day-to-day life. So that was in the mid and late 1800s. Then in the early 1900s, everybody had expected that capitalism was going to implode on itself. And that's what Marx said. The system is going to implode, either because of the natural contradictions that exist inside of it, or because the workers and everybody is going to realize we don't have to stand for this anymore, and they're going to rise up, and there's going to be a revolution, and it will the system will be replaced with this wonderful utopia of communism, socialistic communism. And again, those are all just terrible words for most of us. But the way he talked about them was super attractive, where people actually, they would flourish with one another and everyone would have what they needed. And people would bring their best to the table on behalf of the community. Well, we know that didn't happen. And in fact, the early 1900s was just ran by tyrants, right? In all these settings where capitalism had a chance to fail, it didn't fail. And in fact, in its place, there were iron-fisted rulers. There was Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia and Mao's China and just horrible things that happened. So there were scholars that started to say, how does power work to keep things the way they are? How does power work to just maintain the way things are and protect the interests of one group against the group of the interests of another? How does power work to protect the interests of one group at the expense of another? And that's what all of their writing was doing, is just trying to look and try to understand how do the people that run society manage to maintain a grip on how society is run, and everybody else just goes along with that? And again, there's a whole bunch of stuff to talk about inside of that. But that's what they were doing in the early 1900s and the mid-1900s. And then critical race theory said, okay, well, what if you add race into the mix? What if you actually studied how race and power work together to keep people in a certain place and in a certain way in society? And so in the 1970s and 1980s, there were a group of law scholars that said, let's look very specifically through a racial lens. And we want to say there's actually, well, in response to everybody saying that after the 60s, race really isn't a good category to look through anymore because we don't have racial problems anymore. These guys were saying, oh, that's not true at all. And in fact, we actually should look at race more, because now that we've removed sort of the overt outward racist stuff, the Jim Crow laws, and you're not allowed to eat or drink here and you can't live here or go to these schools, we've gotten rid of that, but there's still patterns and policies that are in place, and there's ways of thinking and being that are in place that are still being maintained that we really need to try to poke into and break apart. That was a lot of words that just covered three major disciplines across over 100 years, and that's what those guys tried to start doing 50 years ago.
I appreciate you saying it's oversimplified so that people don't think that is, you know, all they will ever need to know to understand. But I love the way that you're able to explain that in a way that starts to, at least for those of us who are trying to understand, really putting those in a succinct way to say, okay, I can get my head around that. And one of the things that I appreciate about it is the way you explain it feels de-triggering to me, right? Because we get triggered by all these things. There's been so much laid over top of these terms into our climate today. But really, when you talk about the fact that throughout the history of time, there have been some people who have had more power than other people, right? Always. When human beings, because we're sinful, right? Because we're sinful human beings, when oftentimes when we get power, we use it to exploit other people. And then there, on top of that, there are other things that come into play when you look at the history of race in our country, that makes sense to say, well, if we are a country or a world that has also used power in a way to specifically exploit a certain group of people, I just feel like we can step back and objectively say those things are objectively true. Would you agree with that, or would you push back on me on that?
No, I think absolutely they are. Now, it's interesting because I don't know that everybody has, in fact, I know that not everybody has the same exposure to understanding they don't understand our racial history. I think that's something that everybody says, oh, everybody knows that bad things happened and this, that, and the other. But we're kind of over that, and that stuff's all gone now. That's not really understanding our racial history. I mean, when you actually do a deep dive, even in the church, I think of a book like Jamar Tisby's The Color of Compromise, which is just a very straightforward, here's what happened. You use the word objective. Here's what happened in the way race was handled in the church across hundreds of years. And it was brutal. It was demonic at its core. And it wasn't just in spurts. It was woven into every fabric of our society. In fact, it's so interesting to me, and I know we're going to talk about this, Sue-Ann, when it's interesting now that an idea like whiteness, let's say, where people will suggest that we need to study what it means to be part of the white race, okay? And people get really upset about that. And I just think it's so interesting that for literally hundreds of years, white people had no problem at all distinguishing whiteness from everything else. You know what I mean? Everybody knew what it meant to be white and talked about it very openly and put signs up to say, if you're white, you can come here. Everybody else goes somewhere else, right? It was very out in the public for hundreds of years. And now all of a sudden in the last 50 years, it's like we have this racial amnesia where again, we just kind of act like not only did that not happen or it wasn't that big of a deal, but it certainly doesn't continue on into today in any kind of meaningful way. And how dare you ask me to think about whiteness? It's just, it's really interesting to me how that's flipped around where we can't do that anymore. It's like we don't have the capacity to be able to think of ourselves as a white race now. Isn't that interesting how that's just all of a sudden changed? And really, the last few decades, that's become an offensive idea when across literally centuries, we were very clear about what it meant to be white.
And why do you think that is? What changed?
Yeah. And I want to throw it back to you, too. I really want to hear your answer to that, because I think there's a whole bunch of different possibilities. Because I ask myself for that. Again, I'm not asking just for white people out there. I ask myself, why do I get triggered by some of those ideas? Or why, right? Why is my initial reaction to want to get defensive about it? And I think there's something about, I want to be righteous. I want to think of myself as being a righteous person who is not in any way associated with the evil of racism. That I want to think about it in the past, and I want to separate myself from that. I don't want to think about myself as being receiving benefits or privileges or in any way kind of being given something that I didn't earn. I think that just goes completely against our kind of the American ethos, period. You know, this idea of being privileged in some way or standing on the shoulders of a privilege that I did not maybe even deserve is a little offensive. And then I think today, especially, people are just really turned off by radical progressive politics and everything that seems to come with that, you know, you can throw race in there. Although I think race should be thought about separate from radical progressive politics. It very easily gets thrown in there and is also a category under that umbrella. And people just don't want to have it. They don't want to be forced to be diverse. They don't like the idea of an oppressive DEI, you know, where people are being given jobs that they don't deserve in my place and these sorts of things, or being canceled for saying something that they shouldn't say, you know, being constantly monitored for what language I'm using. That gets on people's nerves. It gets on my nerves, you know? And so it just makes it that much easier to never really have to step back and say, okay, in what ways are some of these ideas true? Or even just to kind of do a little racial mapping of my own life. Why do I think about people that are different from me the way I do? That's always a fascinating exercise to do with a group of people. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to do that, but I've done that a bunch of times. I've been in settings where take 20 minutes and just draw a map of what your interactions were with people that were a different race from you. And why do you think about them the way that you do? What are some of your earliest memories? It's always fascinating to see, to hear people's stories. And they're almost always very racist. Even though they don't think of themselves as being racist, their history usually has been. I'm talking especially for white people. Their history usually has been just pocked with very racist tropes and racist stories that have been passed on through the family. And I say, okay, well then what have you done with that? Why do you think that that's just disappeared from you? And why do you think it's disappeared from society? If so many of us have that as our background, why would we think that that's all gone? So those are some of the reasons I would throw out. What would you say? Are you thinking of anything different from those things as far as why people get?
You know, Ed, that brings up such a great point. I can't help but think about this whole idea of individual versus systemic racism. We're talking about why we as white people get so defensive and talking about race. And I just remember this was this crucial point in my own journey when George Floyd was murdered. I mean, I know so many people were awakened to the realities that I'm honestly embarrassed to say I had spent not enough time in my own life being angered about, being heartbroken over, reflecting on, learning about. And as I started to bring others into that conversation, or I should say, as I started to engage others in that conversation and started to talk about my struggles, I was really taken aback by how difficult it was to talk civilly about some of the broader issues that you and I have been talking about, that you've brought to light in this podcast about the use and misuse of power as part of the racial history in our country over centuries, and implications that might still have for us in our world today. And I think looking back, and I just want to say, as you have already done a great job doing throughout this podcast, like, I'm confessing my own defensiveness here. I'm not trying to put this on other people. But as I was wrestling through my own defensiveness, I was experiencing the defensiveness of others. And so much of it came down to this idea of really trying to grapple with the difference and understanding the difference between individual and systemic racism. And so I'm wondering if you can just talk about the difference of those things for a minute. I mean, so often when we think about or would hear systemic racism, our defensive nature goes up and says, well, everyone's racist. I'm a racist. You're a racist. And I don't think that's actually what it means. And so I was wondering if you could just shed some light on those two ideas and why it so often trips us up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we also end up putting the worst examples usually out in front of us. The worst, you know, when you talk about systemic racism, for example, the way that came up in the last few years was to keep talking about the police force, for example. Are they systemically racist? And I kept hearing different responses to that that I didn't feel like went along with what I think the definition of systemic means, which is simply this. It doesn't mean that everybody in a particular body of people is racist at their core. In other words, that they are overtly hating a different group of people or even prejudiced towards a different people. It's suggesting that there's patterns. Again, just think about these words. Sometimes I think we go by them too fast. There are patterns that have developed. There are policies that we have in place. There's ways, what do you mean? Ways of hiring in place. I use this example in the book, actually, of a Christian school. Actually, I've got four different Christian schools in mind, even when I think about this, because this was true for all of them, that they started in the 70s when desegregation was happening and busing was happening. And one of the reasons that they got established as a Christian school was that they didn't want their kids going to school with the inner city Black kids, very overtly. Okay, I've had these conversations. They started it with very racist intentions, okay? And so without even having to say anything more about it, it was just so obvious that we weren't going to have those kids in our school. It was obvious where our scholarship money would go to, who our teaching, where we were going to get teachers from, what issues we were going to talk about in our classroom and in our social studies classrooms and how we were going to talk about them. That very much was established back in the 70s with their curriculums and all that, right? And so if 50 years later, you're still doing things the exact same way or largely the same way, even though you're 50 years removed from the overt racism of the individuals that started the school, your system has been hugely influenced and marked by that racism. And it is still producing a racist outcome, even if you're not aware of it or paying any attention to it, or you declare from the highest hills that you're not a racist, your system actually is. And you won't know it unless you stop and actually look at it. And ask yourself those questions without getting wildly defensive. And again, I've seen this happen, Sue-Ann. People do get wildly defensive. I've been around people when that was literally brought up, this school, one school in particular that I'm thinking of, and people don't want to talk about that. I think it's a mistake. Why can't we be secure enough in our lack of racism that we could actually explore how maybe the culture that we find ourselves in still has a lot of the aroma of the racist beginnings and origins?
Yeah, that's so good. And I think one of the things that you continually are pushing towards in this book is to just have moments of awareness like that, right? To be able to sit with that in a way that allows us to slow down long enough to sit with uncomfortable questions and to start then going on a learning journey or conversations with others to actually help us answer some of those questions about why is that the case? And not just why is it the case, but then what do we do about it?
Yeah. And you know what, Sue Anna, I also think, honestly, that we, again, we say we, that's a big word that goes all over the place, right? I can too easily express my own lack of racism. Again, everybody just seems to have this very self-righteous attitude about racism. They can admit they have all kinds of other sins, but nobody wants to admit that they sin when it comes to race, which I just think is very interesting. But I don't really know where my racist impulses are until I am put in a situation where I'm a minority with a very different group of people. And again, I described this a couple of different times in the book. I don't maybe know that I'm racist until I'm being led by a non-white person. A non-white person is wearing the leadership hat. Maybe that doesn't affect me. Maybe I don't know that I'm racist until I'm sitting in a lunchroom surrounded with nothing but black students, like at an HBCU. And suddenly you realize that there are things coming to the surface out of your soul that you didn't know were in there because they weren't getting pressed on, because you're only ever with only white people, you know? So it never really gets challenged. So I agree with you, Sue Anne, that sometimes I want to be self-reflective enough that even when I start to feel defensive, this isn't true just with race, but anything, if I start to feel defensive about it, I want to be in the habit of asking why, stepping back from myself and say, why am I having that reaction right now? You know, and that's almost like a personal discipline to catch myself when a defense mechanism is going. It happens in marriage all the time, you know, when I get defensive about something that happens with Amy. For this to become productive, I probably should start by saying, why? Why is that hitting something inside myself? It will be helpful if I can articulate why what she's saying is bothering me so that we can talk about that and then we can get somewhere.
And that's so interesting. Those are such good examples because you just said something. You said when it comes to issues of race or when we are starting to feel defensive when we're in certain situations, that's the only situation oftentimes we don't ask ourselves those questions. I mean, we're taught everywhere in our lives to be self-aware, right? Be self-aware in your marriage, in your relationships, in your workplaces, with your wherever you are. Like, notice what's triggering you. Notice what's coming up. But then for some reason, when it's an issue of race, all of a sudden we feel like we don't want people to ask us those questions. Or all of a sudden there's something deeply I don't know. There's just something really uncomfortable with asking ourselves to be self-aware when we're in those situations.
It really is interesting. And, you know, Robin DiAngelo wrote the book White Fragility, and people have just, you know, very violent reactions to her in a lot of different ways. And I remember when I first heard the title of that book and I thought, yeah, that I don't even need to know what the rest of the book is about. I don't even need to know what she says in it. I think that's just a really clever way to frame what I've experienced, again, somewhat inside myself, but definitely with other white people in the church, is a real fragility when it comes to trying to talk about race in any kind of way. There's just a real fragility. And I just think, again, before we try to figure out what's going on politically or what we think about different phrases or what we think about critical race theory, I think a really good place to start is just to ask, why do I feel the way I feel? Why do I so quickly get defensive? There's room for a lot of good and interesting conversations in that question when you're with other people who are asking the same question.
So, Ed, I'm glad we're acknowledging kind of this idea of just self-defensiveness and naming it and being able to say, you know, where we need to maybe do better at that. You have a whole chapter in the book
about stumbling blocks to Christianity, Christian thinking about race in a way that maybe just some helpful tools that can help us be more reflective, that can help us be more aware when it comes to when we're in those situations and we're feeling that. You give some real practical things. And I'm just wondering if you can share a few of those with us.
Yeah, this was actually one of my favorite chapters in the book because I really do think it's practical. And I think it, you know, when people wonder, well, how do I get better at this? Again, we're not trying to fix people, but we're all on a journey of just trying to get better, trying to get more competent, right? And so some of these ideas, and you can decide which ones you want to play with. One of the things that I think we need to do is to separate the secular culture conflict from the church culture conflicts. We haven't really talked about that at all yet. I mean, there is a battle that's going on in secular culture or just culture outside of the church where race is being used for political purposes, solely for political purposes on both sides. Okay. And there's all kinds of complications that are attached to that. And that's very worthy of being dug into as well. I think there's definitely a place to do that. I want to start, though, by talking in the church, because inside the church, we have a very different motive and a very different charter for how we should use our power, our racial power, or any other kind of power to serve other people. Whereas in secular culture or outside the church, you use power to dominate people and to acquire something so that you can stay on top, right? Both sides are trying to do that. In the church, we're actually supposed to submit ourselves to one another, and we're supposed to take the kind of a one down approach as we move through life with everybody, let alone somebody that's different from us. And so I think it gets very complicated and muddied when we're bringing in all kinds of things that are going on out in society out there. I want to start by, how are we operating as a church in here? How are we treating people? What are the walls that have been built up that maybe need to be torn down? Things like that. That a second one, that we need to educate ourselves out of cross-cultural shallowness. We've already talked about that a ton on this podcast. We need to take intentional steps to say, I recognize that I want to know more about this people. I really don't know. Again, just speaking specifically about the white-black dynamic as a white person, to be able to acknowledge where it's true, I really don't know that much about the black experience in this country. I don't know black culture. I know the bits of it that get served up to me, maybe through social media or maybe some bits that come through entertainment. But I can go way deeper by studying, for example, artists that were writing during the Harlem Renaissance back in the 1920s and this whole decade of amazing output of poets and fiction writers and commentators on society that most of us have had very, very little interaction with. They wrote 100 years ago, but their ideas are still relevant today, and they help shape the thinking of black folks, okay? I talk about taking seriously the theological background that I come from, that you come from, and how that shapes our thinking about ideas like justice or oppression, or how involved we should be in trying to influence social issues and bringing the gospel to bear on social issues. I talk in the book about how when I was in college, I was around two very, very different, very conservative-minded Christian groups. One thought we should just completely separate from culture altogether and just sort of stay in our own discipleship groups amongst ourselves. And they had very good reasons for that. And the other group felt like we should be very intentionally trying to change social institutions because of the gospel. Both of them had just very, very different theological positions. They were all using the same verses and just interpreting them very differently. They were imposing things onto the text in ways that were convenient to the view that they already had and wanted to hold on to. So I think we need to think about that. We need to think about the theological tradition we come from. What Bible verses get taught and focused on in our settings? There's always a selectivity when it comes to what Bible we've been taught. We all want to think that we all know the Bible inside and out. If you've been around, you know, Christian circles, you went to Christian schools or whatever. But the reality is we've all been served up a very selective menu of Bible teaching and Bible verses. It's just kind of the nature of the way things happen in the church. So what might I be missing? For example, why is it that you probably have not been exposed much to the words justice and oppression? And the first time you've heard words like that, they were being spoken by secularists or Marxists. And you don't even realize how big those themes are in the Bible. And it's like, okay, yeah, I really don't know that. Well, why not? Because it's been very selective what you've been taught.
Well, it's amazing when we step back and look at the narrative of Scripture and we look at God's heart for his people, God's heart for the marginalized, God's heart for the oppressed. It's really easy to miss it depending on the lens we are looking at the Scriptures through. But gosh, it's all over the place. I mean, you do such a good job of pointing this out in your book, too. I mean, you gave us some great biblical framework for this. I love that when you start talking about the prophets and, you know, all of the places where people are crying out against oppression and injustice in the Scripture. But we miss it so often. And yet, like in the Old Testament, we see the way that God sets up the nation of Israel. And not only does he give them the law, but then he gives them the covenant code. And he says, this is how you are to treat the foreigner and the widows and those who are not like you. This is how you are supposed to treat those who are outside of kind of the center right now, so that everyone can see who the God of Israel is, right? You move on to the New Testament and you just see Jesus. I mean, Jesus is amazing. And you see him time and time again, how he's moving to the people who are on the outside, the margins of society. And I think so often in our churches, when it comes to talking about issues of justice, of race, of inequality, oftentimes, again, because we're uncomfortable, we get defensive, we want to shut it out. And one of the responses is, well, can't we just preach the gospel? And I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, because I think this idea is from the gospel beginning to end. But I want people to think through, what is your response to that? Why can't we just preach the gospel, Ed? Why do we have to be talking about issues of race and injustice?
We could do an entire podcast just on that. What do people mean by the gospel? And what does that mean? And I write about this. It's one of the most significant things that even got me to finally want to write this book. And that was coming across Carl Henry, who maybe a lot of people don't even know who Carl Henry is. He was a forefather of modern day evangelicalism. So back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, he was writing prolifically. He helped start Christianity Today. He helped Fuller Seminary. He helped found it. He helped found the Evangelical Theological Society. So very orthodox dude and very conservative in his view of Scripture. But he wrote this book in 1947 called The Uneasy Conscience of Fundamentalism. And by fundamentalism, he really meant evangelicalism. That's what the word meant. And what he said was that he was super concerned that as evangelicals were trying to separate from a social gospel in the early 1900s that really did leave out sin and Savior, that there was this movement that was trying to meet people's physical needs, but no longer wanted to talk about their spiritual needs. And so the evangelicals that are part of our heritage said, oh, no, that's not right. They swung the pendulum then and really, really focused on the redemptive message of the gospel, that you're a sinner, you need a savior, Jesus is the answer, here's how you trust him. And that became the main message of Billy Graham's ministry and Bill Bright when he started Campus Crusade for Christ and other parachurch organizations that started up during that time period. And he said, you guys, we're going to have a major problem on our hands if we continue to separate the redemptive message of how you come to Christ and the social implications of having become a Christian. Those two ideas have never been separated before the way they have been in these last 50 years throughout church history. And we need to start talking about how to merge those back together again so that in our discipleship, we are teaching people, really our evangelism and discipleship, we're teaching people how to come to Christ and that they've got a sin problem that needs a savior. And then we're teaching them how that gospel relates to the social issues and the social sin that they find themselves surrounded by in any particular cultural moment. I don't think they listen to him very well. I don't in any way want to disparage the incredible ministries that took place in the 50s and 60s as far as outreach goes. But I think we're living among the ruins and the consequences of having divorced that message from having social implications. And by the way, we were very complicit directly in just flat out racism was still going on in the church in the 50s and the 60s. Black folks can't come to church here. You can't come to our seminary. You can't sit in this spot, or you can't live in this area where you'd have access to these churches, and on and on. So we're living here 70 years later, still trying to figure out how do you merge those two back together again when we basically have been taught, at least again, I've been exposed to teaching that says that that's a secondary issue at best, and we really shouldn't deal with it at all because it will cause mission drift. It'll cause us to drift away from the gospel. While other brothers and sisters are saying what you just said, this is an implication of you having said yes to the gospel. You have to figure out how to move towards the marginalized in society. You have to pay attention to where power is being used to take advantage of people. That's what you do as a Christian. Why would those two not go together? Period. Right? Now we know we're living in a time where that we're not very good at that. We're not very good at, I say we're, I'm not from a background that's good at merging those two together.
Do you see some progress? Do you see some ways that you are seeing churches, bodies of believers who are getting that right?
Well, yeah, and they're doing the work that we've been talking about this whole time, of course. And again, that's why I want to be careful about we. But too often, I think we include ourselves. We think that we're okay. The problem is out there with everybody else because we won't stop, slow down, and check ourselves personally and our community that we're a part of. If you're having these conversations, yeah, this stuff isn't new. And there's always been pockets of believers and movements that have popped up, even back in the 90s with Promise Keepers. One of the huge themes around Promise Keepers was racial reconciliation. And that had a profound impact, I think, at least on people's minds and thinking different about race. And then it just it disappeared, right? As a movement, it disappeared. Well, what's come to take its place? You know, I think too much there's these outlier things that happen, or there's these racial quakes that happen in society that then causes there maybe to be a little movement that rises up within the evangelical world to say, we should pay attention to this. And then it disappears again, instead of it just being woven into our discipleship from the get-go, that we learn how to think intentionally. Sue, and you said it so well about something that is near and dear to the heart of God, who said repeatedly in the Old Testament, don't bring your sacrifice when there's injustice happening in your community. When people are being cheated, people are being taken advantage of, the poor, the downtrodden are being trampled, and you're sitting in here in a pious way, you know, in this service and not paying any attention to what's going on with those people. I spit you out, right? It's all over the place. So why don't we hear those messages consistently? Why is that not our reputation? I think that's what I like to think about all the time. I know it happens in pockets. Why is it not our reputation as evangelical Christians that, no, those are people that watch out for the marginalized. That's a group of people. They know how to take care of immigrants. It's this, forget about the politics behind it. They know how to take care of people that are kind of on the lower tiers of the social ladder.
Yeah. Okay. I got to say three things now. In response to that. Yeah. One, we have a generation of younger believers who are coming up in the life of the church who are not just the future of the church, but are the church now, who look at these things very differently than many of us who may be in, you know, a different generation, who are saying, if the church doesn't figure this out, like they see it so plainly and think, if we are not putting our money where our mouth is, and I say that metaphorically, if we're not putting our money where our mouth is, what are we doing? Who are we as believers? Who is the God you follow? They're asking really deep questions while we are trying to sort out some of the stuff you and I have been talking about this whole time. They're asking a different set of questions, and they are looking to us to move in a way to get it right, because that to them and should be to us is the gospel.
And Carl Henry literally used the young people example again 70 years ago, and I think it's still true today. He said, you're going to leave young people with no other option but to move towards secular solutions. If they can't find them in the church, and this is again where some of the deconstruction movement, right? People are rebelling, not even so much theologically as much as they are anthropologically. Why are you as a people not caring about these issues? Okay, we're going to go over here with people that will. And they end up believing that the Bible really isn't the answer to any of this. That's a tragedy. Okay? And I'm concerned about what a lot of young people are doing. And we get offended by the fact that they're using secular language or they're coming up with secular solutions that we don't like. And I just like to keep turning the mirror back on myself. Why are they doing that? I am failing them somehow as a teacher. Okay, you said you had three. That was one of them.
Well, and now I got to say something to that, because I think that's really good, because one of the things that I love about this book, you keep encouraging, we don't need to be afraid of critical race theory, right? As believers, we don't need to be afraid of it. We don't have to agree with it. No one's asking us to agree with it. It is not a faith-based worldview. And so why would we necessarily agree with it? But what it does do is it exposes some things that are really real problems in our society that as believers can not only convict us of where we're failing in some of these things, but when we then stand up and say, oh, we actually have an answer to some of these things. The gospel is the answer to some of the problems that CRT exposes. And so we can step in the gap and give voice to that in a way that hopefully helps people sort out and live out their faith in a way that merges this, what I see happening in the world and the answer that is the gospel that can make a difference. Like, we actually are holding the answer to those things that when the younger people, as you're saying, when we're not doing that, they're looking for it in a way that we're not providing it.
Good, Sue-Ann. And so one of the things that I like that happened in the book is that I give eight of the tenets or eight of the lenses that critical race theory asks us to look through. And I try to show this is where this goes really bad when it's taken to this extreme, when there's a progressive answer that's given. This is what it looks like when it goes bad. Yes. But this is what this tenet can help us do better. It's what it helps us see different. These are the questions that it will invite us to ask within our church spaces. You can use this as an analytical lens to come up with questions that the gospel wants to answer. So I hope that it serves that purpose for people as they read it, that it shows them how to use the questions to get better from a gospel perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I jotted that down because I thought that was one of the best things in the book. Do you want to insert an example? I don't know if you can do this right off the top of your head, but pick one of those things that CRT exposes and go, what does it mean? What does it counter? Why is it important? And how is it misused?
Well, this is the one that winds up getting me in the most trouble already in reviews and other conversations that I've had with people that are very anti-CRT. But you take an idea like intersectionality, which says that a person who is a, let's say, a minority woman, a Black woman who is in a space with all white men trying to operate, that there is a very good chance that she is going to feel oppression, or she's going to feel left out, or she's going to feel marginalized on two different levels, both as a woman and as a Black person. And that if you're going to deal justly with her, you don't separate those from her. She is feeling both of those at the same time. And I've had this conversation so often in the church and in parachurch settings with women, with Black women who have talked to me without even having access to the language of intersectionality, okay? Because that's a relatively new exposure for us as Christians in the last decade, even though it's been around for 40 years. Without even having exposure to that, they have told me how they have felt like the guys in the room are not thinking about them as women. And the guys in the room, the white guys in the room, are not thinking about this issue through Black eyes. And they don't feel like they have a voice at the table or they're, when they do suggest something, it just gets dismissed or it gets explained away or it just doesn't even get addressed. Okay. And so when I hear the word intersectionality, and that's what the basic meaning of it is, I think it immediately forces me as a white guy who is often one of the eight guys in the room with the one black woman. It should cause me to, again, pause and try to figure out, how am I going to make sure that her voice is heard? It's not that complicated. I'm going to ask her questions. I'm going to make sure that she's got a position at the table that's equal to everyone else, for real. I'm going to make sure that when she says things that I don't understand or get as a male and as a white person, maybe I need to slow down and ask more questions instead of right away just, you know, arguing that away from the table. I think that's super helpful. Now, where it goes bad potentially is when you start talking about sexuality. And when they talked about intersectionality, they said there's interlocking systems of oppression, that you can't separate race, gender, sexuality, okay, ableism, whether you're a handicapped person or not in some kind of way, physical way, ageism, right? So there's all these different ways that you could wind up being marginalized. And I think where we wind up, where it goes bad from my perspective as a Christian, is that I don't think the same way that they do about sexuality, for example. I don't think that you're being oppressed if I tell you that I don't think that homosexuality is God's formula for human flourishing, that I still believe that that is some kind of a distortion. Again, I don't even want to get into this right now, right? But I don't have to ride that train all the way to the end of the tracks. I can affirm you as a woman, as a black person, even as somebody who is a minority when it comes to your sexuality, but I don't necessarily have to take your solution for how I should think about your sexuality. Does that make sense?
It's good words, though, because I think it gives a really practical example of how we can take some of these things. Because, you know, you mentioned politics, right? I mean, we haven't even talked about that much about how political terms get all woven through all of these things. So we're automatically assuming things that may or may not be true based on our political affiliation or what we listen to or what we're assuming about other people. And so what this does, that was such a great example, because what it does is say, okay, I can take away the emotion of it. I can look at this and say, what does it actually mean? Not just the sound bites I'm hearing, not just what my neighbor is telling me about what they think it means, but what does this term actually mean? What is the good in it? What do I need to be really, as a believer, what do I need to be really leery of? You know, yeah. What is it counter and why is it important? How is it misused? And what can I actually learn from it? And so I think that is incredibly helpful approach to how all of us can look at some of these things and go, okay, how can I make sense of this? How can I entangle it, as you keep saying?
Yeah, well, in some of the books that have been written by guys like Neil Shenvey, you know, he's a name that he's kind of built a platform around being an anti-CRT person in the church and exposing what's wrong with it. He focuses on what's wrong. And I could do that too, but he focuses big time on what's wrong and he gives a nod or two to what's right. In my book, what I'm trying to do is focus on what's right and give a nod to what's wrong. Again, I feel like that's been getting beat to death for the last decade. What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? They're incompatible worldviews. They, you know, you can't, if you smell any of these words in your congregation, you're going woke. You're about to go over the edge, you know, and that's kind of everybody's on, you know, on the edge of hysteria. And I think that's not helping. That is not helping the race conversation in the church, okay? That you're constantly on the lookout for woke heresy. So I just want to flip it around and say, if you're in a secure place with your faith and you, maybe that's the other thing that hasn't been said. I don't know that we know our Bibles well enough, honestly. And so I don't know where people can you tell the difference between what is a biblical idea versus just a purely secular idea? Do you know where they potentially overlap with each other and how to separate them from one another? I think I probably give people more the benefit of the doubt in that than I should. And that's probably a danger in my approach, is that I want to trust that people do know their Bibles well enough You know, that kind of contradicts some of what I said earlier. And they can separate them. But I'm focusing on the positive because nobody's done that. Or I don't think it's been done enough, certainly not from white people, to be able to say, yeah, this is what's bad for sure. Here's how this could be useful to you. Everybody keeps saying it can't. You know, the Southern Baptists in 2019 went nuts about that because some people said you could use this as an analytical tool. And the overreaction to that has been, no, you can't. You're treading on, you know, demons when you do that. And I want to say, yeah, I think you can, because theories are like lenses. You can put them on, look through them, see what there is to see, and then take them off again and try on other ones.
That's right. That's right. That's really good. And I think what that does for us is, you know, you mentioned the whole wokeness revolution. Can I call it that? I don't know what to call it. You know, what does it mean to be woke? Well, that's a different question. What does it mean to be woke? What are we even talking about? But what's happened now is that word has hijacked so much of any conversation. Yes. You know, you asked earlier, like, why are we not talking about this in our churches? Well, there's a lot of examples you give them in the book of people who have tried to talk about it, leaders and pastors who have tried to talk about it, and immediately they're getting tagged rather than people saying, okay, what is useful about this? What is helpful? What can we learn? They're getting tagged then as just being woke, whatever that means to people. And then you have this whole cancel culture. And so why would leaders talk about it? Why would the church talk about it? Because pastors are getting annihilated by even trying to have hopeful, helpful conversations and being so misunderstood, and then they'll just go in the opposite direction and there's silence.
Yeah, exactly. No, and Shuann, you're my friend, and I'd say this to you whether we were on a podcast or not. I mean, for me, this book gets published with no small amount of fear and trembling on my side of things, because I know that that's the way anybody that tries to do what I'm trying to do in this book gets crushed for it. And I felt like, honestly, I felt like it became an act of obedience for me and an act of stewardship because of just the experiences that God has given me and the challenge of a number of both white and black friends who said, you got a responsibility, man. You grew up in a very unique way, and you've had these different theological experiences, and you went and got what, a secular PhD in your 40s? Like, who does that? And you know how to talk about race, or you've been talking about race forever. This moment needs some other conservative Christians, you know, who will speak about it in a way that people can potentially, hopefully, hear it. And so that's why I did it, but I've been nervous about it the whole time. Guys, I don't know what's going to happen with my own family, extended family, and you know, friends that we have or supporters of our ministry, because most people are not very patient these days with these kinds of issues, which, again, the irony is the book is actually saying, let's be more patient. As Christians, let's see if we could get to a different place. And 10 years from now, I think you said this to me, 10 years from now, let's legitimately be in a different place regarding the white evangelical reputation when it comes to race and how we talk about race and engage race in this culture. Let's be in a different place.
That's right. Well, Ed, I appreciate your vulnerability and sharing that, because I think just naming that reality, that this is a topic that when we throw it out to people, just, again, people are looking through so many different lenses, so many, they bring so much experience and so much baggage to it, and they automatically assume. And again, I raise my hand. I have done this. I am not saying this about other people. I have done it, where you start to make assumptions about what someone is trying to say, or you shut them down too quickly because of certain words they use. And what I so appreciate about you, and why we started the story with your story, we started this podcast by saying, what is your heart behind this? What are you actually trying to help individuals and the church do when it comes to the race conversation in a way that helps our Black and Brown brothers and sisters be seen and known and loved, and their stories come out in a way so that together we can lift one another up, that we can put one another before ourselves, that we can humble ourselves before one another in a way that the body of Christ is supposed to, it's what we're supposed to look like. Yeah. And I so hear your heart in that, and I just absolutely love that.
Thanks, Sue-Ann. You know, one of the phrases we didn't really use yet, and this would be a good place maybe to start to land the plane, is I'm not sitting around trying to figure out how racist I am or not. And I'm certainly not trying to figure out who the racists are in the room. I think the bigger concern is ethnic indifference. It's just not caring. I barely am able to care. We already said this earlier, barely am able to give energy to caring about people who are like me. It's that much more challenging to care about people who are unlike me or who are different in some way, anyway, let alone racially. And before the Lord, I just want to say, as you continue to give me life and breath, will you challenge my ethnic indifference? Will you help me to care about the people that are closest to me? Again, this goes across all different ethnic backgrounds. I think mostly about white and black people because that's where I've been and where I live. But this is true across all different, in all different racial directions. Whoever it is that I'm closest to or that is in my sphere of influence that's different from me, help me to not be indifferent towards them. Ask questions. Listen to their story. Listen to their experiences. Care about them. I don't have to have answers for everything that's happened to them. But I also could love them by not getting defensive right away if they're telling me something that's hard or they're telling me that they're having a difficult time as a non-dominant culture or person in our space. I could love them by truly listening instead of trying to come up with what I want them to hear, you know, seeking to understand them instead of pouring lots of energy into seeking to be understood. That's what I want for myself. And it's really what I want for anybody that's reading this book. It's helped me to grow my heart as a Christian for people that are different from me, especially in these racial spaces.
Well, I've just been sitting with the book for about 4 to 6 weeks, and it has helped me grow already. And so I appreciate that. I am really excited about the way that I think this book is going to advance the conversation. It's going to help people who are really trying to sort it out, right? Who really want to get this right, who are really trying to set aside their political platforms and some of their biases and really trying to understand what are we saying and why does it matter. And I think this book really does that. I'm so hopeful for the conversation it is going to create. And I just cannot wait for people to read it.
Thanks, Sue-Ann. Me too. I mean, especially as we're heading into this political season, it's like a perfect storm. You know, some people said we needed this 10 years ago and they've almost rebuked me for it, which I've had to work through in my soul because I know they're right. But then they always come back and say, but yeah, this isn't going away. That's part of the problem. And it's about to get, we're about to start hearing about race and CRT more than any of us want to again in these next few months as we head into this hostile political season. Let's be the church. Let's figure out how to be the church in the midst of it.
That's right. Amen to that. Well, Ed, I have one final question for you. Before I ask that final question, I just know we've waded through so many things today. And I just wonder if there's anything that you didn't get to say about this book, about what you're trying to help people understand about untangling critical race theory that you feel like would be important for them to hear before we wrap up our time.
I mean, it's going to sound crazy to say no, because I feel like we really have already talked about all of it. Even what we just now did is what I would want to say, that I want this book to be an aid in helping us to slow down, think about our own journey, and think about how to love other people better. Right. And so it'll help sort through a lot of the words and the language and what's good, what's bad, just like you already said. But at the end of the day, it's about being able to build relationship with people and to think about people differently across racial lines. So I hope it does that. It's for the people that actually want that. People that have already made up their mind and don't have any more questions and already know that they're fine, and it's not going to help them. I already know that. But I believe that there's a huge chunk of white people out there that actually know something's not been right in their background and even in the way they experience life, and they want to do better. They want to have tools, mental tools, to be able to move towards people in a better way. And I hope this will help them do that.
So, final question of the day. I ask everyone who comes on my podcast what I call my deeper still question. this podcast is called Deeper Still because we are people who are in process, right? We've been talking about it this whole entire time. And just sometimes when we get to a place where we feel like we figured a few things out, God calls us to go deeper with Him, deeper with other people, deeper with the world around us. And just when we get comfortable, He calls us to go deeper still. And so what is a place in your life right now where God is calling you to go deeper still?
Yeah. Wow. That's such a good question. Oh, for the last 10 years, I have been learning to live with unresolved conflicts with people where I feel like as much as it's depended on me, I have done all that I feel like I can do. Again, whether that was done well or not, I'm not saying that I'm sitting in this place of righteousness. I'm just saying I've done all I feel like I can do. And the situations remain unresolved, either because the other person doesn't want to come back to the table, or they're just not in a good place in their own process, or sin, or whatever. I don't even know all the different reasons, but I don't like what's happened in the last decade. And so I've really been wrestling with God about that, about what am I supposed to do with all of this unresolved stuff going on around me. Again, there's a ton more behind this. You're asking me to answer this question, and this is a 90-second answer. It's a three-hour conversation. But I've got to make peace with that because I can't fix. There's just some situations you can't fix. And it's hard for me to live with that. Not because I think everything always has to be worked out, but I just don't like when it's not even being addressed, or we're not even trying to come back to the table with each other. I'm very unsettled by that in my life. And I have to trust God with it in ways that I have never had to do before. I'll hit period right there. Like getting counseling help. Like I'm finally at a stage at 56 where it's like, all right, you counselors, I need somebody to help me. I need an older, wiser man who I'm actually meeting with down in Cincinnati. I've met with him a couple times now, who's just had great, great pastoral and leadership perspective for me that I need. I need somebody to give me a view on how to live with living in a broken world, which I thought I had worked that out. I thought I had mastered being okay with living with my own brokenness and other people's. And I just realized, no, man, I don't know how to deal with it. And it's messing with me. So there you go.
That's a perfect way to end this conversation. Actually, that is a great model to everything that we've been talking about today, for you to confess that you're a work in progress and that God is never quite done with us in so many ways. And so, Ed, I appreciate you. I appreciate your work. I appreciate your friendship and all that you do on behalf of so many people. And so thanks for taking time out to be here today. And just best of luck to you as you continue to just get your book out to the world and have these conversations that need to be had in order for all of us to just do better, be better, all of the things. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks, Sue-Ann. This was great. Thank you.
Well, friends, thanks so much for tuning in today. As I said at the top of the episode, we didn't get to nearly all of the things that I wanted to get to today, not even close. But the good thing about that is if this conversation has piqued your interest, if you want to take a deeper dive into understanding really how to untangle critical race theory in a way that will help you and me and our churches have a better discourse with one another, especially as we head into the 2024 election, I would highly suggest picking up a copy of Ed's book, Untangling Critical Race Theory, What Christians Need to Know and Why It Matters. And perhaps not just reading it for yourself, but do it in community. Do it with others who can share their experiences, wrestle through it together, and hopefully it will, as an end result, be something that can help us to listen, love, and advance the conversation about race in a way that just honors one another and brings glory to our God. Well, friends, we'll be back in 2 weeks with Drew Dick, the author of Just Show Up, How Small Acts of Faithfulness Changes Everything. So until then, don't forget to pay attention to how God is calling you to go deeper still and go in His grace.